All right, everybody, and welcome to another show of The Premiere with DJ Jazz here on Penguin Radio. So today we're winding down in terms of October, but we still got a couple more shows left, this one and another. So we've got another horror movie today on The Premiere, and we're going to be going over Silence of the Lambs. Silence of the Lambs came out in 1991. It's an American psychological thriller, and it's directed by Jonathan Demme. So Jonathan Demme adapted the novel Silence of the Lambs, which is what the story is based on, with screenwriter Ted Talley. The novel came out actually in 1988, and it was written by Thomas Harris. And it was the second book he wrote to feature the character of Hannibal Lecter, the first one being his novel The Red Dragon, which came out in 1981. So Dr. Hannibal Lecter, who's the main character of the story, even though he is also the villain of the story, is a brilliant psychiatrist, but he's also a serial killer. And what he's known for is he'll kill people and then he'll eat them. He's known as Hannibal the Cannibal. So he would kill and murder people he didn't like, and also some of his patients. And also while he was doing this, his heart rate never reaches above 90 beats per minute, which is a regular person's just relaxed heart rate almost. Most athletes, and when you're exercising, it gets higher up in terms of almost like 120, maybe above that, but 80 or 90 is, you're supposed to be calm, but this is his heart rate when he's committing these atrocities. So it's almost like he's pure evil. So we're going to get into the plot of Silence of the Lambs. So if you haven't seen it and you don't want to hear about the plot, don't listen, because I'm about to talk about it right now. But if you have seen it and you enjoy it, or if you haven't seen it but want to know about it, listen up, because here's how it goes. So the movie starts with an FBI trainee by the name of Clarice Starling, and that she's played by Jodie Foster. And she gets pulled from her training at the FBI Academy, which is in Quantico, Virginia, by a detective by the name of Jack Crawford, who's played by actor Scott Glenn. And he's of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit. So she gets pulled from this training, and she gets assigned to interview Hannibal Lecter, who's played by Anthony Hopkins. And he's a former psychiatrist, now imprisoned in the psychiatric ward of a maximum security prison. And they're hoping to gain his insight on the pursuit of another serial killer, which is at large nicknamed Buffalo Bill. And Buffalo Bill is played by actor Ted Levine. So the reason he's nicknamed Buffalo Bill, one, in part, is because they don't know his name, and two, because Buffalo Bill in history was a frontiersman who is a paid hunter of buffalo. His name was William F. Cody, and he would skin the animals for their pelts and then sell them. And the serial killer which they're chasing has actually skinned some of his victims. So one of the examiners ended up giving him the nickname Buffalo Bill, and I think the newspaper used it, and then it stuck. So Hannibal, despite being demented, he's also incredibly intelligent, and he has a good skill in reading and interpreting people's behaviors and actions. So she travels to the Baltimore State Hospital for the Criminally Insane, and she's given instructions and rules on how to speak to Hannibal. Don't get too close to the glass. Don't tell him anything personal about yourself. So she's getting all these rules while she's being walked down to his cell. And when she finally does walk down to his cell, instead of being a stereotypical prison cell door with the long bars going up and down, it's this large, thick pane of plexiglass, basically. And it has holes drilled in the front to aid with speech. And then there's a slot in the side, which they're able to transfer in and out different items which Hannibal might need to look at, books and pictures usually. And in fact, around his cell, he has these hand-drawn pictures of locations he's been to and misses, such as Rome, and other books that he's read. So as she's walking up to the cell, the camera is as her point of view, so it's sort of like you're watching as she walks up closer to the cell. And the closer she gets, you realize Hannibal's actually been watching her the whole time. As he comes into view in the cell, he's actually just already looking at her. So already he seems very creepy and off-putting. So Hannibal's already watching her, and initially he's pleasant and courteous, and he's polite, saying how, you know, he doesn't get many visitors, but he demands personal information from Clarice in return for help in tracking Buffalo Bill, and he cites quid pro quo, which is Latin, and it means something for something or this for that. So he's saying he will give his help and his aid in capturing this villain, but he needs something from her in terms of personal information. He used to be a psychiatrist, and he enjoys still analyzing people and understanding why they do the things they do. So this is what he's asking from Clarice. So after a small conversation about just things about her past, just little trouble things from her past and her childhood, Lecter eventually becomes annoyed, and Clarice attempts to analyze him, trying to get him to take this psychology test, and he refuses, and she kind of tries to defend herself, but Lecter tells her that a census taker once tried to test him, and he ended up eating his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti. So he has no problem just getting rid of and then eating the people who are offensive to him, or the people that he doesn't care to deal with. He'll just get rid of them and or eat them. So he ends up just basically insulting her and berating her, and so she goes to leave, and then Lecter calls her back and tells her that she should seek out one of his old patients that he used to help. So with the name she gets, she ends up finding this storage unit who is owned by the patient, and in it she discovers this man's severed head, just the disembodied head of this man. And when they bring it in to examine it, they find this sphinx moth forced down the throat of the actual head. And so the sphinx moth, which if you've seen the movie poster, it's actually on the movie poster, and it's also known as the death's head moth. And it has that name because the pattern on its abdomen is actually in the shape of this human skull. And they're found in eastern parts of Europe and Asia. And so after realizing that she followed Lecter's clues and found something in relation to the case, she ends up returning to his cell. And Lecter, when she returns, Lecter is happy, but he still gives these vague clues in terms of how to help Buffalo Bill. He doesn't really give all the information he has. He just gives Starling these clues. And he also divulges at this point that the man who he told her to track down was in a relationship with Buffalo Bill and had told Hannibal in a consultation while he was a psychiatrist that he was worried that his partner, Buffalo Bill, was getting violent and might act out against him. So Hannibal offers to profile Buffalo Bill and then aid in his arrest. In return, he wants a transfer to a different lower security institution and away from the warden, Frederick Chilton, who he doesn't get along with and despises. So while this is going on, Buffalo Bill in another part of the state abducts a woman by the name of Catherine Martin, and she's played by actor Brooke Smith. And Catherine Martin actually ends up being the daughter of a U.S. senator. And what happens, how he ends up kidnapping her, is he poses as a mover, and he's trying to get a couch into the back of his truck. And when he asks, can I get a hand? And so when she goes to help him, he kind of makes it so she ends up getting in the truck first with the couch, and then he just attacks her, knocks her out, and drives away in his truck. So Clarice and Crawford, who's her superior and kind of her handler at this point, they're called to this rural Midwestern town when they get the body of another woman who shows up along the river. And this woman is missing large sections of skin from her back on each side, up and down the back, the whole length. And as well, they find another of these sphinx moth lodged in her throat. So it's at this point that Clarice sees this connection. And so she goes to a local university where she has some connections to some of the scientists and the researchers there. And she goes to find out about the moth, and she learns about what it is, the death head moth. And more importantly, she finds that they have to be imported through special order to the U.S. And they require a lot of care and attention to keep alive. And the scientist who's studying the larva that they brought in notes that someone had to have loved this guy. Someone had to have kept it warm, kept it constantly fed, made sure everything was perfect in order for these things to go through their metamorphosis. So Buffalo Bill, as evil as a person as he is a serial killer, he still has the time to take care and manage these moths. As well, he actually also has a small dog by the name of Precious, and it's not the dog you would think a serial killer would have. You think if a serial killer would have a dog, it'd be a big 90-100-pound dog that could just jump on you and rip your arm off. But no, it's this little tiny soft white dog. And that actual dog, Precious, will actually come into play later in the movie. So while they're still searching for Catherine, her mother, the U.S. senator, sends out this message on public TV saying that whoever has her daughter, if she's still alive, you still have a chance to change your mind and do the right thing. And she says that all she wants is her daughter home and safe. And Starling sees this, and she points out how smart of a move this is. Because if Buffalo Bill sees the message and he hasn't killed Catherine yet, it'll make him more sympathetic towards Catherine because of seeing the state that the mother is in. And it'll be harder for him to finally kill Catherine when it comes that time. So Buffalo Bill is actually keeping Catherine in this large dry well, which is in the basement of his house. And Catherine, when he kidnaps her, is kind of large, a heavier set. And what he does is he's starving her. He gives her food, but he doesn't give her as much food. So she's starting to lose all this weight. And she, at one point, pleads with him to go home, that she just wants to see her mom, that she won't tell anyone anything. And you can see Buffalo Bill kind of start to tear up or crack up as though he's starting to feel sympathetic. And then he just goes ballistic and gets really angry and then snaps right back into it. And then from then on, he just shows no emotion. So it appears that the senator's plan is working, but it's slightly working, or at least it's not going to work and save her. So they still need to find her. So they see no other option, and Crawford gives Starling the authority to offer Hannibal Lecter a fake deal for a prison transfer, and in return he will give information that'll lead to the arrest of Buffalo Bill and then rescue Catherine Martin. So when Starling goes to propose this to Lecter, he still demands quid pro quo once again, and he offers these clues about Buffalo Bill in exchange for personal information about Clarice's past. And at this point, when he talks to her, she retells the story of her father's death, who was, he was a man of the law. I forget if he was FBI or police, but he was an officer of some sort. And he was killed in the line of duty when she was 10 years old. And so she retells that whole event to him, and being at the funeral and walking up to the casket at 10 and seeing her father dead. So she retells this tragic moment from her past to Hannibal, and it suits him enough. So she, he agrees to the deal, but Chilton, who is the warden at this point, actually secretly records the conversation and then reveals Starling's deceit to Lecter, and then offers Hannibal his own deal of a prison transfer without the knowledge of the FBI. So when they eventually find out that Chilton has made this deal, he's already on his way out. He's already gone from Baltimore. So Lecter is going to be transferred to a lower security facility, and any information he has is actually just going to be given directly to the mother of Catherine Martin, the U.S. senator. She made a deal with Chilton that she wanted to meet Lecter personally. So before Starling can really do anything to stop it, Lecter gets loaded onto this plane to head for Memphis. He's flown to Memphis, Tennessee, and when he arrives, the senator expects him to tell, you know, something good, some information about where she might be, but he only berates her and insults her and says, you know, how do you feel that your daughter has fallen into the hands of a serial killer? And they're leading him away, and she's done with him, and he stops and he gives her a location in Illinois as well as the name Louis Friend, or Louis's friend. So they, just with these little clues, they try and track down someone in Illinois. And while they're leaving to go to Illinois, Starling actually notices that the name Lewis's friend is an anagram for iron sulfide on the periodic table. And iron sulfide is fool's gold. So she realizes at this point that Hannibal actually gave the senator false information. And so she goes to visit Hannibal Lecter in a courthouse. He's on temporary lockdown, hoping that she can get the truth from him. So we're going to take a little break, but we'll be right back in a couple minutes. I'm DJ Jazz on the Premiere, and this is Penguin Radio.
By the DJs of Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu.
You're listening to radio.dominican.edu.
All right, welcome back to the Premiere. We were just talking about Silence of the Lambs, and we're getting into the point where Clarice has realized that Hannibal has given the FBI false information, and so she is going herself to visit him. So Lecter at this point is in between transfer from the Baltimore psychiatric ward he was in, and he's being held in this makeshift cage-like cell in the center of a Tennessee courthouse. And so she goes to him and demands the truth. And Lecter informs her that all the information you need is in these case files. You should have figured this out already. So again, he's going to give her clues, these vague clues that she will be able to then figure out what Buffalo Bill's plan is. But he still berates her and insults her by saying, oh, you should have had this. Like, how could you not have seen this? You must be stupid. So rather than give her a name, he insists on one last quid pro quo, one last something for something. So he asks why she feels it's so Lecter asks Starling why she feels it so necessary to try and save Catherine Martin. And she recounts this traumatic event from her childhood when she was on a family farm or a relative's farm as a child, and she woke up at night to the sound of screaming. And when she ran to go investigate, she discovered it was the spring lambs who were being slaughtered for food for the springtime. And so she takes one of the lambs and she attempts to run away with it. And then, you know, she's only a little kid, so she's eventually found and the lamb is taken and then eventually slaughtered as well. And Starling admits she actually will sometimes wake up at night and she still thinks she can hear the lamb screaming. And so Hannibal Lecter speculates that her motivation to save Catherine in the movie is in hopes that it will end these nightmares or put an end to the nightmares, or as the title entails, it will silence the lambs, because Starling has this motivation to try and save Catherine because she couldn't really save this innocent lamb as a kid, and it still haunts her to this day. So she feels the need to want to save someone who's innocent and who's put in a perilous situation. So Lecter gives her the case files back, and he made some annotations to them, and he gives them back just before their conversation is broken up by Chilton and state police, who escort her from the building. And so Starling looks at these annotations, and she discovers that Buffalo Bill actually knew his victims personally, And so he races to the hometown of the woman who was killed, and she hopes that she can ask around and hopefully find something. So at this point, Lecter is given a meal in his cell, and he escapes his handcuffs and then locks one of the officers around the cell bar. And when the other officer steps in to help, he attacks him and actually just starts biting chunks out of his face. As I mentioned before, Lecter was a cannibal, and he would actually eat some of the people he killed. And so at this point, he just attacks this officer and starts biting his face. And he eventually passes out from shock. And Hannibal picks up the man's baton and then beats the other officer to death with it. And at this point, he actually looks over onto his table, and there's a drawing he's been doing of Clarice. The whole time he's been in the Tennessee cage, he's been drawing this picture of Clarice, and it's actually really good. That's one of the things that's very interesting about Hannibal Lecter, is he's this brilliant man, this skilled psychiatrist, and he's a great artist. In almost all the movies he's in, he has all these paintings and drawings of venues and portraits of people, and yet he's this psychotic killer and this cannibal. So it's almost seeing the high points of man and the low points of man all rolled up into one person. So at this point, Hannibal is free, but the other officers know that the two policemen have been attacked because they haven't come down in a significant amount of time. They're only supposed to be up there long enough to give him his food and leave. So knowing that something's up, they have most of the rest of the police and the riot squad respond to the building, and they take the elevator up and rush the courtroom to discover that one of the officers is mutilated and strung up on the cell, roped up on the cell door, and then the other is lying on the ground and his face is really badly mutilated, but he's still alive. So, and Lecter's nowhere to be seen. So while they're evacuating the injured officer through the elevator, the police notice that there's blood dripping from the roof of the elevator. So without saying anything, they quick get the injured officer out, and they shut down the elevator, and then they send officers above to open the door and then look down in the elevator shaft to see what's on the roof. So when they look down and see what's on the roof of the elevator, it's actually Lecter in his white prison uniform on top of the elevator. And so they tell him, you know, put your hands up or put your hands behind your back. And, you know, they give him these orders and he doesn't move at all. So they decide to fire a warning shot into his leg, and they do, and they hit him, but he actually doesn't even move once he gets shot. So finally they decide to open the security hatch in the top of the elevator. And when they open it, they find out that the person in the prison uniform is actually not Hannibal Lecter. And in the ambulance, the body of the officer sits up and his hand goes to his face, and you find out that Hannibal Lecter is actually in this officer's uniform and has cut the officer's face off and placed it over his as a makeshift mask. And so he sits up in the ambulance and then takes this mask off, and his face is just covered in blood and he's got these wild eyes, and then it just cuts away. And you just find out later that he killed the rest of the ambulance crew and then took the ambulance, and then he ends up escaping custody. And so it's just this really graphic way of escaping police, that he uses another man's face as a mask to escape police, but he ends up just disappearing into the wind nonetheless. So Starling is unaware of this at the time, and she continues to investigate the small town where the victim lived, and she discovers that Buffalo Bill was actually a tailor, and she finds these dress swatches and patterns of fabric over places where he used to live, and she finds out that the patches of skin that were removed from the victim's bodies are actually very similar to these patterns of fabric that she's finding at the places he used to tailor. And she realizes that Buffalo Bill is actually attempting to fashion this woman's suit out of real human skin. And when she realizes how demented he actually is, she contacts Crawford and she gives him this information. And then also at this point, you realize that all the women that Buffalo Bill's abducted were larger women, heavier set,
And then he starves them in this dry well in the basement of his house so that they have this sort of loose skin. And then he kills them and then takes the skin to use as material for this this suit that he's making. So she contacts Crawford, who is her superior, with this information. And he lets her know that they're already en route to make an arrest with a unit of FBI and police. They had cross-referenced Hannibal Lecter's notes with hospital records and found that a man named James Gum had unsuccessfully applied for this sex change operation due to psych evaluation. And so they are heading to a place in Illinois to arrest him while Starling is in Ohio. So they each decide to follow up on their lone lead because they figure Starling might find some extra evidence that'll help bring him in once they arrest him. So Crawford leads this FBI task force to the address under James Gum in Illinois, and Starling just continues to ask questions of people who knew the victim in Ohio, and she's led to this house who was owned by a friend of the victim. So Catherine Martin, who's being held captive in Buffalo Bill's basement, is able to lure his dog, Precious, towards the edge of the hole with food, and then is able to get her to fall into the hole. And when Buffalo Bill hears the dog in trouble, he goes to investigate, and Catherine Martin has the dog, and she's kind of keeping the dog hostage and threatening, saying, you know, it's got a broken leg, she needs help, you need to call someone, and you're going to have to come down here to get her. And so Buffalo Bill starts getting angry and sort of hysterical, and he grabs his huge handgun. And at this point, Crawford's team goes up to the door and ring the doorbell. And Buffalo Bill hears the doorbell, so he starts getting clothes on and prepares to answer the door. So the FBI, not getting an immediate response, wait and then burst through the door. And as they burst through the door, the film makes a sharp cut to Buffalo Bill opening the door and Clarice standing outside of the house asking, oh, hi, you know, I'm Clarice Starling of the FBI. Can I ask you some questions? And it's at this point you realize that the whole FBI task force is outside the wrong house. And it's a brilliant way of doing it because they literally wait until the final moment of when the door is kicked open and when he opens the door for you to find out that it's the wrong house and that they're states away from each other. And so... And he uses the name Jack Gordon when he talks to her. And he does give her some information that seems to help her investigation. And then when she brings up a name, he goes, oh, I have a business card for him. Would you like to come inside? And when she goes inside, the camera pans around the exterior of the house which they go into. And all that's around is maybe one other house that looks almost vacant. A trailer and train tracks. That's the only other thing around outside this house. So in Illinois, at the where all the FBI are, one of the officers goes up and goes, you know, the house is empty. And Crawford looks up and goes, oh my God, Clarice, because he realizes that she's actually at the right address, but she's also all alone. It's just her. So while Buffalo Bill is getting this card, Starling keeps asking questions, and she begins to kind of suspect he's not who he is. And then she actually sees a Sphinx moth fly into the room, and she realizes then that it's Buffalo Bill. So she pulls a gun on him, but he's able to escape into the basement. Starling then follows Buffalo Bill and discovers Catherine Martin, who's still in the dry well, but she's all right. And Bill actually... you don't see him for a while, and then he turns off the electricity to the basement, and he can see Starling through these night vision goggles he has on, and he's just sort of stalking her, and he's following her right behind her through this dark. So he goes to cock his handgun to shoot her, and the sound of him getting the handgun ready gives him away, and Starling's able to turn around and shoot him, and he ends up being killed. At this point, there's this fade out, and then it kind of comes back to some time later where Clarice Starling is at her FBI graduation party, and she gets told that there's a phone call for her. So when she goes to the phone, the person on the other end is Hannibal Lecter, and he congratulates her and says, you know, good job on graduating the FBI, and he tells her he's at an airport in Bimini, and that he doesn't plan to pursue her and ask that she return the favor. And she says, I can't do that. I'm an FBI agent and you're on our most wanted list. I can't do that. So Lecter says, okay, that's your choice. And he ends the conversation saying that he's going to have an old friend for dinner. And when he says that, he's watching this plane, all these passengers come out of this plane. And Chilton, his previous warden at the Baltimore Center, comes out of the plane and begins to walk away. And so Hannibal hangs up the phone. And the last shot of the movie is Hannibal following Chilton through this crowd of people as the credits begin to roll. So at the end, they make it aware that he's going to follow Chilton and then kill him and then eat him for having an old friend for dinner. So that's the basic plot of Silence of the Lambs. And it's a very dark movie. And while it's a very dark movie, it still has a lot of really good writing, a lot of really good script writing, and a lot of really good scenes where it's just Hannibal Lecter and Jodie Foster. And if you listen to the dialogue is amazing. And as well, the filming of it and the shots they decide to use are really interesting as well. And everything just really adds to the horror aspect of the movie. When you see Hannibal a lot, most of the time, it will be directly, the camera will be directly zoomed in on his face to where his face is just encompassing the whole screen. And you're forced to look at nothing but just his stare. And Anthony Hopkins, when he portrays Hannibal, almost never really blinks when he plays Hannibal. His eyes are almost always open and they're very wide open. And he's almost like his eyes are just piercing right through you. So we're going to take another small break. And then when we come back, we're going to discuss the cast of Silence of the Lambs. So until then, this is the premiere with DJ Jazz on Penguin Radio. All right, welcome back to the premiere with DJ Jazz. We were just about to get into the topic of the cast of Silence of the Lambs. So Jodie Foster plays Clarice Starling, who's the main protagonist of the movie. Jodie Foster was interested in playing the role immediately after she read the novel, but despite Jodie Foster having just won an Academy Award for her performance in the 1988 film called The Accused, the director, Dem, he was not really convinced that she was right for the part. And his first choice was Michelle Pfeiffer, but she turned it down because she was worried about the subject matter of the movie. Foster gained the role because of her passion for the part, and she was really persistent about taking up the role. And she received largely favorable reviews and ended up winning an Academy Award, Golden Globe, and a BAFTA for her portrayal of Clarice Starling. In contrast, some of the reviewers criticized the film as misogynistic because it focused on these brutal murders of women, and there was a lot of claim of homophobia due to its main villain, Buffalo Bill, wanting to be this transgender person and wanting to be a woman. So they had a lot of claims that the movie was homophobic. Anthony Hopkins plays Hannibal Lecter, and he's most famously known for the role of Hannibal Lecter. The director, Dem, actually originally approached Sean Connery to play the role, but he turned it down, and Anthony Hopkins was offered it just after, based on his performance from Elephant Man. And he portrays Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, and he won an Academy Award for Best Actor in 1991. And then he reprises the role as Hannibal Lecter twice in Ridley Scott's movie Hannibal, which came out in 2001, and then Red Dragon, which came out in 2002. But his original portrayal of the character in Silence of the Lambs has still been the most famous, and it's been labeled by the American Film Institute as the number one film villain. And so that's a really hard title to achieve, especially with the American Film Institute. They are very picky about how they label and how they label who gets what award. So to be labeled the number one film villain is quite an achievement for Anthony Hopkins. And at the time he was offered the role, Hopkins was actually making a return to the London stage acting, and he was performing in M. Butterfly. And he had come back to Britain after living for a number of years in Hollywood and having all but given up on his career there. And he was quoted as saying, "Well, that part of my life's over. It's a chapter closed." But the author was actually very pleased with Hopkins' portrayal of the antagonist, Hannibal Lecter. So despite feeling like that part of his life was over, he still gave one of the best performances of his career. Ted Levine, who plays Buffalo Bill, that was his breakout role, was playing Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. And then there was a period where he was just typecast as a villain in various roles of different movies. And then he was able to sort of remedy this by playing more positive characters, like a member of Al Pacino's police unit in Heat, which is another good movie. And he played Paul Walker's police superior, Sergeant Tanner, in The Fast and the Furious. So after that, he tried to fix his career by showing he could do more more nicer roles, not so much the serial killer that he played in Silence of the Lambs. So for the development of the movie, it was based on the novel, once again, by Thomas Harris. His novel came out in 1988. And prior to its release, Orion Pictures actually partnered with actor and novelist Gene Hackman to bring the story to the big screen. And with Gene Hackman set to direct and possibly star in the role of Hannibal Lecter, negotiations were made with the company to split $500,000 cost of rights between Hackman and the studio. And Michael Mann, who is another writer, had the novelist, had the movie Manhunter, which came out in 1986, and it was loosely based on Thomas Harris's 1981 novel Red Dragon, which did feature Hannibal Lecter. And it was the first of four to feature Hannibal Lecter. But Manhunter made barely half of its budget back at the box office. So the producer, by the name of Dino De Laurentiis, actually gave away the rights for Hannibal Lecter to Silence of the Lambs producers for free. So he gave away all the rights for Hannibal Lecter so they could do the movie for no money whatsoever. And then Lecter's second movie ended up making $272.7 million at the box office, which is about $264 million more than the first. So he gave away the rights to a multi-million dollar piece of merchandise for free, which is insane thinking about it now. But it's really hard to gauge whether something's going to be so successful at that point. And for him to have just done a movie featuring a similar character, basically the same character, and to have had it show no money, it didn't seem in the moment that ludicrous to just give it away for free. But I bet looking back on it now, he wished he would have asked for at least something in return. So in November of 1987, Ted Talley was brought on to write the adaptation for the screenplay. And when Talley was about halfway through the first draft, Gene Hackman actually withdrew from the project, and then the financing for the movie fell through. So as a result, Orion Pictures sought director Jonathan Demme, and he was brought on to help fix the project, and the screenplay was still not yet complete, but he signed on after the reading of the novel, and the project quickly took off. And as Ted Talley then explained, he was just startled by the speed of things. "We met in May of 1989, and we were shooting in November. I don't remember any big revisions." So when they looked at the screenplay together, they had both liked it and they both agreed on most of what was written. So there wasn't much time that was wasted in terms of rewriting the script. So they were able to get right into filming. The FBI had actually impressed Jodie Foster recently because they had handled a death threat that was made against her. And they had really earned her respect. And so when filming had just started, she actually approached Jonathan Demme and she wanted to make sure that the FBI would be portrayed in a correct way because they had helped her out. So she wanted to make sure that she was portraying them in the way they wanted to be seen. Hopkins was the one who actually had the idea for Lecter to wear white when he's in his prison garb because he wanted to channel people's fears that they had already had of doctors and dentists, these people who are seen as these people of authority or these people in, you know, healthy or health positions, people that are supposed to heal like a psychiatrist, like Dr. Lecter is, and yet they can hurt you or they can cause you pain if they're not careful or if they wish to, like Dr. Hannibal Lecter. So principal photography for Silence of the Lambs began on November 15th of 1989 and then concluded in March 1st of 1990. And the filming primarily took place in and around the Pittsburgh area in Pennsylvania with some scenes that were shot in nearby Northwest Virginia. The plexiglass cell that Hannibal has been kept in has become sort of this famous scene or this famous set in film. But the real reason that they used this plexiglass wall was because director Jonathan Demme felt that the stereotypical prison bars would ruin the mood of the scene. So they decided to have this big glass wall be the actual door to the cell. And now it's, if you've seen any other movies where there's a villain that they need to put away, they almost always put him in a glass cell. I think they did it in Star Trek. I think they did it in X-Men. They did it in the Avengers. They put Loki in like a glass cell. So the whole glass cell putting your is the spot to put the villain is sort of become a stereotypical thing now. And I believe that one of the major first times it was shown was during Silence of the Lambs. So there's actually a scene where Starling tells Lecter about the lambs, and a small crash can be heard partway through her dialogue. And this was because a crew member actually dropped a wrench in the background, but Jodie Foster liked the take so much and she hadn't broken despite the noise that she actually convinced director Jonathan Demme to keep that cut in the movie. So if you turn up the volume at that point, you can hear the wrench falling, but it was, in her opinion, her best take, so they decided to keep it. There's also many shots of characters talking to Starling, and when they talk to her, they're talking directly into the camera. But Starling is actually always shown looking slightly to the side of one of the camera. So whenever she's speaking at the camera, if you pay attention, she's actually speaking just to the side of the camera. And the reason for this was because Jonathan Demme wanted to make the audience watch the film from Clarice's point of view. So whenever she is listening to another character or another character is speaking, the camera is her point of view, and the audience is feeling the story and feeling all the different emotions and dialogue as Clarice. And then when she is speaking, she gives just enough of that off-angle shot so that you can sort of listen to her but not feel apart from the movie, so you can snap right back into it when another character is speaking to her. So it lets you sort of engulf yourself in the movie and sort of become a part of the movie if you really fall into it. Buffalo Bill's home is actually the house of a high school physics teacher. At the time, he was still living there, and he taught at Bentworth High School, and his name was Harold Lloyd, and he actually claimed that some of the crew were really rude to him and that items from his house were stolen. And he had a security guard fired because he was running tours through the house at night and charging people money. And last summer, the house actually went up for sale, and then in January, the price was dropped to $250,000. So if you want to move out to Ohio at any point and you feel like living in the house of a fictional serial killer from Silence of the Lambs, and you've got $250,000 just lying in your pocket, then you got a nice spot to live in. I mean, like I said, the only thing around is really one vacant house and train tracks, but I mean, if you like solitude, then maybe you'd like to look it up. So Another interesting fact was, in a rare act of cooperation, the FBI actually allowed scenes to be filmed at their academy in Quantico, and some of the FBI staff members even acted in small bit parts of the movie. And the final day of shooting, the final scene they shot was the scene in the basement where Clarice finally finds Buffalo Bill and then eventually kills him. And the scene took about 22 hours to complete, and it was their final day of shooting. So it almost took an entire day to complete shooting. So the reception of Silence of the Lambs was mixed. It's now seen as a really critically acclaimed movie and as a staple of horror in terms of media and film. But when it came out, there was a lot of speculation over whether or not it was deemed as appropriate for mass media or mass release. So Silence of the Lambs was released on February 14th of 1991, which is actually Valentine's Day. And that was one thing that people thought was interesting, was that they released this movie, which is about such violent acts against women and such violent acts in general, to be released on Valentine's Day. It almost seemed like they did it on purpose, you know, ironically, to get people to try and see it, more people to try and see it. And it ended up grossing around $13,766,814 during its opening weekend and surpassed its own budget after the first week. The film proved to be a major box office success, and at the time it closed on October 10th of 1991, the film grossed $130,742,922 domestically, with a total worldwide box office gross of $272,742,922. And the film actually ended up being the fourth highest grossing film of 1991. Silence of the Lambs was a sleeper hit, which means it gradually gained widespread success and acclaim. As I said before, the fact that there was so much controversy over it being seen as homophobic or being seen as misogynistic and violent and promoting violence towards women meant that its initial release was slow and that not everybody was willing to go and see the movie. But once the word got out of the performances and how actually good the movie was, it started to gain all this critical success. And Jodie Foster, Anthony Hopkins, and Ted Levine actually garnered much fame off of their performances. And Silence of the Lambs then became the third film to win the Big Five at the Academy Awards. And the Big Five are Best Picture, Best Director for Jonathan Demme, Best Actor for Anthony Hopkins, Best Actress for Jodie Foster, and then won Best Adapted Screenplay, went to Ted Talley. And it was also nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Director. And in terms of a horror movie, and in terms of if you've seen the movie or if you watch the movie and you watch some of the stuff that happens, it's really violent. And it's a violent story, but it still can be told in a way that makes it credible and makes it worthy of winning these awards. And so it's just interesting to see how these people can turn something that's so ugly or so violent and make it worthy of awards, of these several Academy Awards that are extremely hard to get, ask Leonardo DiCaprio, and yet a story that's so violent can be told in a way that gives it such critical acclaim. And I think it's one of the best horror movies ever made, in my own personal opinion, and I do recommend watching it. I don't think it's on Netflix, so you might have to go out and track it down, but it's a great movie. It's also the first and so far the only Best Picture winner at the Oscars that's widely considered to be a horror film. Not many horror films end up winning Academy Awards most of the time, and it's actually only the third such film to be nominated in the category. The first was The Exorcist, which was in 1973, and then the second was Jaws, which was 1975. So there again, it's one of the only horror films to even be nominated, and it's so far the only one to actually win the final award. And then in 1998, the film was then listed as one of one of the 100 greatest films in the past 100 years by the American Film Institute. And it was considered culturally and historically and aesthetically significant by the U.S. Library of Congress, and was then selected to be preserved in the National Film Registry in 2011. So that's going to do it for our show tonight here on The Premiere. Tune in next week on Monday. We'll be doing the last horror-themed show, and then we'll be getting back into regular movies, whatever I decide to talk about that week. But it'll be interesting nonetheless. So until next time, this has been The Premiere with DJ Jazz on Penguin Radio.